Hello and welcome to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Canucks. I'm Brendan Batchelor, as always, joined by Randeep Janda. And Randeep, it's a great time to do a show this week because the Canucks are winning and playing well. They went down to California. They won all three games against the Sharks, the Ducks, and then most impressively against the LA Kings to conclude the road trip on Thursday night. And they come back home on a heater, getting set to face the Edmonton Oilers on Hockey Night in Canada on Saturday.
Yeah, going to Cali used to be a real terror for NHL teams, and in Vancouver Canucks, not so much anymore. They come back undefeated, and a couple of things happened on that trip. Their goal differential is positive. They've got a 7.08 points percentage, and most importantly, in my opinion, there was a conversation around this team of, all right, you lost to Carolina, you got smoked by the New Jersey Devils. Can you beat good teams? Well, the answer is yes. The LA Kings, who were number one in the Pacific Division before that game, the Canucks took them out and took them out in pretty comfortable fashion.
So from the road trip, what stands out to you in terms of reasons why they're starting to have success, and in particular the LA game? Because I think there were some flaws in their game in San Jose. They beat a pretty bad team in Anaheim. But the LA game is one where you can say, okay, some things are starting to coalesce and come together here, and it's part of the reason they had success.
I think it really does come down to the Achilles heel of this team going against LA in previous years was, can you play against a fast team? Can you handle them in transition off the rush? Can you limit those opportunities in batch? Going back to that New Jersey game last week, the Canucks had trouble there. They go to San Jose, they win that game, but transition chances were given up. And really, to come from this road trip in the final two games, Anaheim, yeah, they're not a good team, but Vancouver gave up no transition chances in that game. That was a good step in the right direction. And they continued that against LA. Let me remind you, the LA Kings, that's their bread and butter. They're waiting for you to make a mistake, and they've got speed, whether it's guys like Adrian Kempe or Trevor Moore, or go through the list, you know, Quentin Byfield had an opportunity. He took advantage of it, but they do that on a night-to-night basis. And Vancouver, other than that one goal early in the game, did not make those mistakes. They were good in the neutral zone for the majority of the night. They were, you know, tracking back so hard, skating so hard on the back check to make sure that if LA had an opportunity, that it was scuffed out almost immediately. So I think the biggest takeaway from this trip is you clean up your transition defense. You're not giving up those opportunities, which is playing to the style that Rick Tocchet wants this team to play.
And one of the things that we've talked about early in the season, and especially when the Canucks were scuffling a little bit, is that you need your best players to be your best players. And looking at the game in LA, I would say Quinn Hughes was very good. Kevin Lankinen, their starting goaltender, who is emerging as one of their best players with the start to the season that he's had, have both been excellent, and they were both key factors in Vancouver's ability not to just win in LA, but to have success on the road trip as a whole. And that's encouraging when, you know, JT Miller's playing through something, and we know that Elias Pettersson isn't up to the speed that you would hope him to be, and now potentially you're not going to have Brock Besser in your lineup, depending on what the outlook is for his injury after the hit from Tanner Jeannot.
For sure, and having that resilience is what I'm going to call it, where, yeah, there's situations in front of you, whether it's a JT Miller injury, whether it's Pettersson not clicking right now, the Brock Besser injury, we'll have to wait and see how long he's out for, hopefully not long, very dirty hit by Tanner Jeannot, but that resiliency of the ability to reset, not only from game to game, but in game, right? There's a moment in that game where Besser, your leading goal scorer with six goals, your leading playoff provider as well with three goals there, if he's out of the game, there's a chance that you can kind of crumple there. But the Canucks in game reset and they came back stronger. Guy stepped up. Jake DeBrusk had an excellent goal. Quinn Hughes doing his thing. So I think there's a real, you know, rather than having maybe what they looked like at the beginning of the year, even though they're winning games, there was a lot of volatility in game. This was steady. And that's exactly what reminds me of the Vancouver Canucks from last year. Now, the question is, can you keep that going? You got some tougher matchups coming in, Edmonton coming up on a Saturday night. Can you keep that going against decent level of competition?
Yeah. And I think I want to talk about Lankinen in particular a little bit here, because he is playing very well. He's a big part of why the Canucks are having success. He's making the Thatcher-Demko conversation not as part of the forefront as it might be. And it's a good sign that Demko's been back on the ice with teammates a couple of times here. So maybe this isn't as important a conversation as we think it might be. But what happened with Thatcher Demko? What's a part of the reason that he's going through these injury issues right now? I think it's fair to say you could argue that he was overplayed and potentially overworked in practice. And I know the Canucks haven't had any back-to-backs yet this season. They'll have their first back-to-back next Saturday, Sunday, when they host the Blackhawks and then the Predators on back-to-back nights. But do you need to get Artur Shelov's in here? Do you need to alleviate some of the workload from Kevin Lankinen? Or do you just ride him right now because he's playing well and you hope that Demko's back soon enough that it's not a factor where Lankinen gets played into the ground and suddenly you don't have Lankinen and you don't have Demko potentially?
I feel like you have to give Shelov some games here, where that Chicago game on Saturday night, could that be one for him? And maybe Lankinen gets the revenge game against the Predators. Later on this month as well, you've got the Bruins and the Penguins on the road, a back-to-back. Batch, looking at Thatcher Demko, of course we've heard positive reports where he's stringing together good days. But this is an injury that no other hockey player has had. There's a lot of uncertainty there. So I won't assume anything until I see Thatcher Demko on the ice in a Vancouver Canucks game jersey, starting or sitting on the bench. That's something that I think we have to make sure that, you know, that's the reality of the situation. It's until we see Thatcher on the ice in a game, I'm not going to make any assumptions on his health. With Shelov's, you got to give him some confidence here, and you got to give Lankinen some rest. I think it's very much a real conversation of overplaying a player. He's got the last eight of the last nine starts. You don't want to keep on doing that. You need to have a little bit of confidence in your backup to win games, even if they're against, you know, poorer teams. You know, the Blackhawks aren't setting the world on fire right now. Neither are the Penguins. Those are two games I look at to say you need to give Lankinen some time to rest, and those are probably the games.
Yeah, well, and that back-to-back, Shelov's is going to get one of those anyway, you would
for
imagine,
sure.
Whether it's Chicago or whether it's Nashville. You're right, the Penguins later in the month is certainly an option once they get out on the road.
I would even look at the Ottawa game on the 23rd just to be like, all right, if you're trying to get another start in there, Ottawa's a good team, but if Shelov's is going to stay in the NHL, he's going to have to play, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a six-game homestand that's starting on Saturday against the Oilers. There are some games you could get him in there, too, other than that back-to-back. After Edmonton, Calgary comes in. The Islanders come in. As mentioned, he's going to get one of Chicago or Nashville. So I guess the question is, out of these six games, do you need to get him in twice, or is once on those back-to-backs okay? And do you look at trying to give him a chance to go back against the Flames in spite of how things went in the season opener for him?
I think you try to give him a couple of games, but I don't know if you want a second look from the Calgary Flames on. If Artur Shelov is still having that trouble, you know, essentially tracking the puck from distance through screens, Calgary, you know, played him very, very well, and they had the book on him. NHL teams do their pre-scout anyway, so whether he gets a game against the Islanders or the Senators, they'll all have a pre-scout on him. I just don't know if that previous experience, like Calgary has the book on him. They wrote the book on him for this season. I'm not totally comfortable with that one, just because I think throwing him against a Chicago team, maybe an Ottawa team, maybe the Islanders on the 14th, they're all getting their first look at Artur Shelov for the most part. So do you roll with him in those matchups? That might give him a little bit more confidence.
Yeah, I was looking at this. I'm thinking, okay, maybe the Islanders on Thursday, the 14th, as you said, and then maybe you come back with him on the Sunday against Nashville on the second half of a back-to-back, because we know the Predators are scuffling early mm-hmm. in the season here too, and then he doesn't have to play two games in three nights, and you get Lankinen a bit of rest. Or conversely, you do play him the two games in three nights and try and get him on a bit of a roll, and then Kevin Lankinen would have, what, 4 days between games to get a bit of rest, to get some work in with Marco Terenius. Like, I'll be really interested to see how they manage the goaltending, specifically on this homestand, and then that's going to carry forward into that road trip. You're right, Ottawa's an option. I would expect him to play that Pittsburgh game if Demko's not back by then on Wednesday the 27th, because that's a back-to-back with the Bruins on the first night. But I think we're both in agreement that Artur Shelov has to get some starts and has to take some minutes away from Kevin Lankinen this month, unless we're talking about Thatcher Demko being back imminently. Before we get out of here, because once again, we're going to take an early break so we can get to the mailbag, and we've got lots of questions that we want to answer. Let's take a moment to look ahead to this game against the Oilers. Edmonton hasn't had a strong start to the season. They're coming off a couple of losses here as they face the Canucks. They lost to New Jersey on Monday. They lost to Vegas on Wednesday. They've had a couple of days between games here. They've got McDavid back in the lineup. What should we expect from this matchup? The first official matchup since Game 7 of the second round between the Canucks and the Oilers.
Yeah, this is an Edmonton team that's in a very interesting spot. Last year, they had, a bad record to start off the year. We saw what happened to Jay Woodcroft. But in some ways, their play is actually a little bit more worrying than last year. They were in a lot of close games last year. This year, if you start looking at their team stats, their transition defense last year and their goaltending was a problem. This year, Batch, their penalty kill is at 59.5%. It's the worst in the NHL by far. Remember, this was a PK that was 95% in the playoffs. So they're like the Vancouver Canucks were under Bruce Boudreau. They can't get a kill to save them right now. The power play, which is at times looked like the best power play in the history of the NHL, is sitting at 27th, and they're making mistakes in key moments. They were up 2-1 in that Vegas game. They end up losing with about 40 seconds left in that game and don't pick up a single point. So there is some problems right now. They can't score, they can't defend, they can't play on special teams. So they are walking into Vancouver, not the most confident group, and Vancouver's got to take advantage. Do not let Connor McDavid have his marquee game against you. He hasn't looked like his usual self coming back from his injury and even before that. So I think, Vancouver playing a confident game and really not shooting themselves in the foot, puck management and making the right decisions. If you play your game, I think Vancouver has an excellent chance to win this game against that Edmonton team that is struggling right now.
So we'll talk more about that and get into the mailbag when we return. This is In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to In the Booth on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Canucks. Brendan Batchelor and Randeep Janda with you. And as always, I'm going to take this opportunity to remind you that if you've missed any part of the show listening on the radio, it does live as a podcast as well on the Canucks Central podcast feed. So make sure to subscribe to that to get In the Booth every week, to get every Canucks postgame show with Sat and Bick, and to get Canucks Central every weekday with Sat and Dan Riccio as well. All right, Randeep, let's open the mailbag, and we're going to start with a question from Justin in East Van. And this is a different one, an outside-the-box question, which I like. Justin asks, if you had a time machine and could call any Canucks game in the past, which game would you choose?
Ooh, that's a great question from Justin in East Van. Going back well back into time, just because my hockey fandom really developed in 1994, I think calling those games, in whether it was like having that call of whether it's Brandon DeBure, or I would never try to replace the Jim Robson calls, obviously, but just having a role in any of those broadcasts with Pavel Bure on the ice, I'm gonna go and say probably Brandon DeBure, or that era of Canucks hockey.
Yeah, that's a good one. I would probably lean in that direction too. But for the benefit of having a different answer, I'm going to say Game 7 against Chicago in 2011.
Yeah,
would have been a great one. And again, I'm not going to live up to Shorty's Slade the Dragon call, but to be able to call such a huge moment in Canuck history would be a really cool moment. And hopefully we get a chance to call a big game like that sometime down the road here, maybe later this season, who knows. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I would say Brown DeBure for sure. You could look at the Bieksa goal to send them to the Stanley Cup final. That would be another good one. The Greg Adams goal against the Maple Leafs. There's lots of really cool moments in Canuck history that it would be cool to have been on the call for. And hopefully we create some of those memories going forward.
Well, just jumping in there real quick, though, because you know what makes both of those goals, whether it's the Brown DeBure or the slaying of the dragon goal is like you see the play develop, right? Whether it's the stretch pass to Bure or Campoli messing it up and Burrows, like you can see it happening. There's an anticipation. There's a bit of a crescendo with the Bieksa goal. It was just a weird goal. Like, you know, it's one that doesn't have that anticipation. It's a heck of a moment, but, you know, as a play caller batch, that's also a bit of a weird goal to call in real time.
Yeah, well, and, you know, Shorty is the only guy that got that call right. You know, all of the TV broadcasters missed it, didn't see the puck. So, in fact, yeah, maybe I'll retract my vote for that game because I might have screwed up that call royally. And that's the number one thing that you fear is a guy calling big games is that you somehow mess up like an iconic goal and then they can't use your call and it goes down in infamy. So yeah, I'll avoid the Bieksa one. That's a really good point. Next question. Great question, though, Justin. Thanks for that. JD writing in says, is Sherwood one of the better acquisitions the Canucks have made in a long time? And how valuable is Myers to this D? He looks calm under pressure right now. So let's start with the Sherwood part. Where would you rank Kiefer Sherwood? Again, small sample size early in the year. He's been really good. He's becoming a fan favorite. I think it has to be fair at this point to say that he is, in fact, one of the better acquisitions they've made in recent years, especially as a guy that, you know, didn't come with a ton of term or a big paycheck, but has an opportunity to be a very important part of this team going forward.
For sure. And I think with Kiefer Sherwood, there's layers to his game. It's not just all energy. There's some playmaking. Against Anaheim, we saw the Danton Heinen goal and a great job by Kiefer Sherwood to set up that play, be aggressive, but at the same time show off some soft hands with that pass. We also saw his quick reaction. He is not afraid to pull the trigger to score goals, whether it was the quick goal off the faceoff or the goal against Anaheim in transition, or even against LA. There was one opportunity where the puck was kind of hopping and Kiefer Sherwood took a swing at it. Like, he is not afraid of taking a shot at goal. So I think this year for sure, he's no doubt probably as of right now the best acquisition the Canucks have. And you could argue further down the lineup, one of the better acquisitions across the NHL. He's on track right now to set the NHL record in hits with 500 plus hits. But even looking back at like last year's team, which was so strong, Batch, when you look at the acquisitions, who was the best acquisition last year for the Canucks?
Dakota Joshua, probably.
For sure, but he was, you know, he was a guy that had been on the team for even a year before that,
yeah,
right? So he joined the team in 22-23. I would argue it's probably Ian Cole based on his regular season play. You know, Lafferty had a good stretch too, but my point is, though, they're impact players, but they're depth pieces, where with Kiefer Sherwood, he's got some upward mobility. He's got some versatility that you can see maybe there's more here. Maybe there's a little bit more offense in his game. So I think, you know, looking at last year's roster, and I'm not including Nikita Zadorov because he was an in-season pickup. I'm not picking up talking Elias Lindholm. I'm talking about guys that were picked up in the offseason. I feel like, you know, Sherwood, over maybe even going over the last 2 years, has been one of the better, probably the best pickup thus far. I know it's early.
Well, and, you know, I don't think it's fair to look at Zadorov and Lindholm in the same category,
sure,
anyway, because those guys were rentals, as it
yep
turned out, whereas Sherwood has the opportunity to have a longer impact for this team. Like, yeah, right now, I would say in terms of depth pieces that this organization has brought in that have had some of that upward mobility, it's Sherwood and Joshua, and that, you know, is basically the end of the conversation. So, you know, full credit to Patrick Alvin and Jim Rutherford for unearthing another great player that is going to help this team. The second part of JD's question, he says, how valuable is Myers to this D? He looks calm under pressure now. And I think that's a really interesting characterization because it hasn't been the best start to the season for Tyler Myers. And if there's any talk around this team and where they need to improve and where they might need to make acquisitions, it's on the blue line and maybe more specifically on the right side of the blue line. So my answer to this question is when Myers is playing to the style that we know he can, when he's playing well, he is a very valuable member of this team. He's a key penalty killer. Rick Tocchet trusts him in key situations. He had him out late in the game, protecting the lead against the LA Kings when they had pulled their goaltender in the final game of the road trip. So Myers is a very important part of this team, but there is an onus on him to play to the level that he showed he can last season as well.
He's generally also a player batch. You appreciate it a little bit more in the playoffs because the physicality that he can bring, he brings it in the playoffs. You can get away with a little bit more. The beginning of this year, though, has been a bit of a struggle for that pairing. Tyler Myers, I thought, of course, that pinch in the New Jersey game was probably his not the greatest moment of the season, or you could argue the biggest mistake he's made this year on that 1-0 goal. But Carson Soucy and Tyler Myers have had a bit of a challenge to start off this year. I think it's a little bit more with Soucy, who played a heck of a game against LA. He was more of the Carson Soucy we're used to seeing. But with Tyler Myers, that spot on the right-hand side, even though he's got it in him, even though he can jump up and play on a second pair and eat, 20, 22 minutes if you need him to, I think that sweet spot is ideally at some point, whether that's a month from now, 2 months from now, in the lead up to February and March, you want to add a little bit more to that right-hand side. Tyler Myers is capable of playing on a second pair. He's capable of showing that he can be a physical presence. He can make the simple plays. He can be calm under pressure. But for a team that has playoff aspirations and then doing something in the playoffs, if everything goes right, could they be a team that goes on a deep run? You need a little bit more depth on the right-hand side. So I like Tyler Myers' game. I think he's gotten a rough ride in the city often just based on the way he plays. Maybe it's because of his height and, it looks kind of wonky at times. But I think you need a little bit more depth. So he's done an admirable job. I think he's going to get better as the season goes, as the game ramps up in later parts of the season. But you still need some depth on that right-hand side.
Yeah, and then the question becomes, who is going to provide that depth? Who are options on the market? I know everybody's talking about Rasmus Anderson, but right now the Flames have had a better start to the season than anybody expected they would, so I don't think they'll be looking to move him anytime soon anyway. So this is kind of the trouble they ran into last year, where they made an addition to the blue line, but it was Nikita Zadorov, who, in spite of what he brought, is a left shot defenseman, and you wonder what that option on the right side looks like and whether they will be able to find a right shot defenseman to help complement those guys, or whether they have to do what they did last year, which is bring in another left shot guy and essentially have someone play their offside down the lineup potentially.
Yeah, and you had flexibility. I mentioned the name earlier on. Ian Cole was a great veteran to have on that team where he could play on the right hand side. You don't have the same maybe level of comfort that you did last year further down the lineup when it comes to the defensive side of things. So, of course, picking up a lefty that can play the right-hand side could be something that you look at. But, Batch, this is also a team that is going to have to look at that. I think the scarcity of the right-shot defenseman in the NHL is such that there's going to be probably five or six teams, if not more, fighting for the same two or three defensemen. So this is going to be a game of musical chairs. Whenever they do free up, whether that's on a impending UFA or a player with term, there's not many players that are going to be available that fit that need. So there's going to be probably a bit of a bidding war. There's probably going to be at least two or three teams that miss out on that right shot D. And you're right, a lefty will have to do for a majority of those teams.
And following up on that question, Reed writes in and asks, do you think Tom Vilander is trending towards signing after his NCAA season, and would he have a realistic chance of becoming a right D option for the Canucks in the playoffs? And that is an interesting way of thinking around this sort of issue, where you might not be able to get a right D on the open market, but you've got one within your organization if he indeed wants to sign at the end of the year, wants to come in and play. My only thought about that is that I don't know if I want to trust my hopes on the right side for a team that fancies itself a contender right now to a guy who has literally never played an NHL game at this point. But it's interesting thinking, and it wouldn't be unprecedented to see a guy come in late in the season after his college year, sign a contract, and play a role in the playoffs. It's just not something we've seen in recent Canucks history, in large part because they haven't been in the playoffs for most of the last decade.
Yeah, going back a decade, I remember when Dante Fabbro had his first NHL experience with Nashville doing exactly that. He got games in early in the playoffs, and that was a kind of a look for him. But, Batch, This is a guy that's got 45 college games under his belt. Sure, he played pro hockey in Sweden to a certain extent, 1 year, and barely that. Remember, you know, he was playing in the junior level of Swedish hockey. So, yeah, I guess that could be an option. But my counter to that is, who do you feel more comfortable with? If you're looking within the organization, would it be a Tom Villander who has barely played, who hasn't played pro hockey, and definitely in North America as a 19-year-old, or are we talking about a player like Cole McWard, 23 years of age, right-shot defenseman? He's got nearly 70 games of AHL hockey. He's played at the NHL. So if you're looking internally, and I'm not saying, you know, you bank everything on Cole McWard. Of course, you go in the trade market and you look at other options. But I feel like the internal options that the Canucks do have may not have the high ceiling that a Tom Villander has long term. But in the here and now, that right-hand side in Abbotsford is going to give you more pro minutes, more comfort, I think, in the short term than taking a risk on a younger player that still has to show that he can play on, you know, North American ice and can play pro hockey. That's a huge ask for a player coming out of college.
Yeah, and, you know, you're right. Like, not just with McWard, but you've got Mark Friedman. You've got Desharnais, who's playing right now. You've got Noah Juulsen. Like, depth on the right side is not their issue. It's quality in terms of trying to raise that floor, or maybe even put yourself in a situation where if you could get a Rasmus Andersson type, just speaking hypothetically, that you bump Myers down to a bottom pairing role with a lot of penalty kill minutes, and that could be a role that suits him even more effectively. But in terms of like Tom Villander coming in, and, you know, maybe it makes sense. Maybe he does sign at the end of this year. Maybe they get him into some games and, you know, he's a black ace that they take a look at putting into the lineup. If it looks like he's going to give them better immediate minutes than some of these other options we've talked about. But in terms of really fixing things or improving things on the right side, you know, I think Villander would join frankly, quite a crowded group of right shot defensemen. But are any of those guys going to give you the level that you really want in the playoffs? And perfect example, they bring in Desharnais. They're going to work with him. Maybe he'll improve over the course of the season to a point where you're comfortable with him playing. But he wasn't an every night guy for the Oilers in the playoffs last year either.
No, he wasn't. And you're going to have to build that depth, whether that is, you're right. You know, my example of Cole McWard shows that there is depth within the organization. Mark Friedman's gone down to Abbotsford, picked up 4 points in five games. So you have right shot depth. It's just a matter of the ceiling. And with Villander, long-term, the ceiling is there. The here and now, though, Rasmus Andersson is a player that you look at. I know the Bowen Byram discussions have been going on in Vancouver of, could he be a player that may be on the way out in Buffalo since they're looking for forward depth? And could Bowen Byram be a trade chip? But yet again, we're talking about players that are not natural righties, playing on that right-hand side. And that matters to players, right? When we're talking about individuals, and Philip Broberg is a classic example of that. He was playing the right-hand side. He actually took Vincent Desharnais' job in the playoffs. But a part of the reason, other than money, of course, that St. Louis appealed to him was that he was able to play his natural left-hand side. They had too many lefties in Edmonton, and Broberg was able to go to St. Louis and say, all right, you need a lefty? I want to play my natural side. So that does matter to players, and it is a talking point of which side are you playing? Is it your natural side? Some guys don't care. Some guys, it does matter.
Next question is from Jay on Twitter, who writes in and asks, in how many games will Hughes get his next 300 assists? So that was the big story this week. 300 assists in 376 games, the third fastest defenseman to 300 assists in NHL history. So that's the question, Randy. When's he going to hit 600 assists?
All right, so I'm looking at the fastest to ever reach 600 assists in NHL history. And you won't be shocked that it was Wayne Gretzky with 416. After that, Mario Lemieux at 514, Bobby Orr at 608, and then Connor McDavid at 616 games.
So you're, in terms of defensemen, you're looking at that 608 Bobby Orr
608.
Number and saying, can he get there? Probably That's, not. Probably not. That would be steep.
Would it be 630 games? Like, I could see that. I could see him being in that range, 600 You know, if I were to make a guess based on the trajectory he's on right now and the way he continues to look like he's getting better, of course, we're talking about another 300 assists. That's not easy. But, is he going to get better? Is the pace going to ramp up or is it going to slow down is the question here.
In the short term, I think you have to assume that it's going to ramp up. It's just whether that pace carries forward to the point of 600 assists. Like, in the short term, I would imagine he's going to produce at a pretty good rate, and he's always been a guy that has been a heavy assist guy as opposed to a goal guy, although we're seeing him score more regularly to start this season. So I think I'm not going to put an exact number on it, but I think he'll be faster in these 300 assists than he was in the first 300 assists, but probably not by much. So if he's under, 675, is that's like a realistic ballpark for me. Like, or under 700, shall we say. If he's under 700 games to 600 assists, then I could see that for sure.
All right, I'm going to give you an actual number, which won't mean anything, but who cares? I like throwing numbers out there. I'm going to say 674 games. Let's see if it amounts to anything, but I agree with you. I think he's going to be in the next, especially 2 to 3 years. I think we're about to see, you know, this player just show the NHL how good of a player he is. Not a defenseman, how good of a player he is. And we've been able to see that the last couple of games here. Just, he is giving me McDavid vibes in the sense that, you know how Connor McDavid can make other players look foolish? Quinn Hughes is doing that right now.
And he also makes his teammates look better, too, which is something you can say about great players in the league. And this leads perfectly into our next question from @PrincessErica84 on Twitter. She says, I know they play different positions and in different eras, but do you think Quinn Hughes is giving Pavel Bure a run for his money as the most talented Canuck ever? Some of the moves he's had lately have been just insane. I think he will lead us all the way. And I think the specific usage of the word most talented is what's key here, because I don't think we're going to argue that Daniel and Henrik Sedin are the greatest Canucks ever, and what they did for the organization over such a long period and the records they broke and the points they produced are something you can't take away from them. But we're talking about just singular offensive talent. I would still say Pavel Bure is up there as number one in Canuck history, maybe a little biased from growing up through that era. But I agree that Quinn Hughes is giving him a run for his money. And Quinn Hughes might be able to marry those two things I'm talking about, where, you know, yes, Bure was this elite talent, but he was kind of like, flash in the pan is not a great term to use, but he wasn't in Vancouver a long time. So it was exciting for a short period, and then he was gone. The Sedins were these great players that played their whole careers as Canucks. Could Quinn Hughes do both? Can he be the most talented player in Canucks history while also having the longevity of some of the other guys that have their names in the rafters at Rogers Arena?
What makes this conversation, this fantasy conversation, great is that, you know, they're stylistically, they're so different, right? Pavel Bure was power, skill, really the player that was so cool that everybody wanted to be, because there's an element of the wow factor being from raw power and just skill, right? This is the Russian rocket. He would fly up and down the ice, but he'd also do cool things like the off the skate goal. Quinn Hughes is so special at what he does. And skating is the commonality there. They're both very good skaters, very different skaters, of course. Quinn is so good on his edges, and he's able to just be so shifty. And Batch, that play, especially the second, the goal that Quinn Hughes scored against LA, where he's just going side to side, and Akil Thomas has no chance on that. Just shifting, waiting, finding the right angle, waiting for JT Miller to get to the front of the net. And I've been watching that goal on loop, and it reminds me of basketball, right? You're basically, he's just crossing up Akil Thomas and waiting for the shot. It's basically creating your own shot. And he does that on a hockey rink. He does that on a sheet of ice, not on a hardwood floor. It was fantastic to watch and just kind of go over again and how special he is. I think at the end of the day, we're going to be having this conversation. I'm a Pavel Bure guy, just like you are. Growing up, he was my favorite player. He's the reason I got involved in hockey. But I think from a pure skill, perspective on at the end of his career, Quinn Hughes, his vision, his skating, I think he might be number one if he continues this way. I'm a full-on Bure guy, but he's going to give him a run for his money, and we've never seen anything like Quinn Hughes, I would argue, definitely in Vancouver, but he's showing something that league-wide people haven't seen either.
And our next question from Gord Locke is about Quinn Hughes as well, but it's a little bit of a different perspective. Gord writes, if the Quinn versus Makar rivalry ends up being like HBK versus Bret Hart in the 90s, is Evan Bouchard the Tatanka of the group? Feuded with both, former IC champ, so he's quality, but come on, he's not in that tier.
Well, I feel like he deserves a little bit more respect. Tatanka was, who's the Razor Ramon? Because Razor Ramon would have fought both Shawn Michaels and had a classic match against Bret Hart. I don't think Evan Bouchard is Razor Ramon level yet. Maybe that's, I don't know, another Norris winner like Adam Fox or something like that. I'm not sure. Chico, but like who? Tatanka, I never even considered that. That's a great poll, Gordy.
Yeah, well, and my question is, if Quinn and Makar are HBK and Bret Hart, then how's the screw job playing out? Who's Vince McMahon, and how's all of that coming together? So that's, we're going to have to sit and think on that one, Gord. So maybe hit us back in future weeks, and we'll have a full analogy for 90s wrestling compared to Norris Trophy candidates in the NHL.
Although I do got to say, I think we know who Vince McMahon is. It's got to be Gary Bettman. So.
Oh, of course, always.
So
always.
That role is filled.
Next question comes in from Jason Maurice on Twitter. Will Pettersson find his offensive game if he works hard on his defensive game? And this is a great question because the answer is yes. But I think we've seen that. I think Elias Pettersson, arguably for my money, played his best game of the season in LA, and we're starting to see him trending in the right direction, starting to see him moving his feet, starting to see him being a presence at both ends of the ice and getting to the areas on the ice that he needs to get to have success. So that's a great way to put it, Jason. I think absolutely he'll find his offensive game by working on his two-way game, and I think that process is already beginning.
Yeah, you noticed him for all the right reasons, and there was a confidence in his game. I think there was, a couple of shots, four shot attempts, also ended up having one shot on goal, but I didn't really care too much about the offensive play. I'll be honest with you, I thought in a head-to-head matchup versus Anže Kopitar, Elias Pettersson's line won that matchup. And this is a Kopitar that was coming into this matchup on a six-game point streak. He had, picked up a hat trick. He had three-point games this year. And it was pretty resounding victory for Pettersson's line, outplaying that line for the LA Kings, the top line. So, yes, I think he's getting more confident. I love the way there was defensive commitment. There was, breaking up plays and the limited transition attempts that LA had. They were trying to conjure up something, but the entire Canucks team did a good job of tracking back. But I thought Elias Pettersson played really strong. And this is a confidence thing for Elias Pettersson. If he plays a confident brand of hockey defensively, it's going to translate offensively. He scored against Anaheim. He puts together another good game against LA. I like where he's trending. Of course, you're not seeing that dynamic skill just yet, but this is, we don't know the full information. There's been speculation on whether he could be hurt. Other things, we don't know a lot when it comes to this team because the team is pretty tight-lipped on these sort of things. But I think from a confidence-building perspective, Batch, he played a very, very clean and physical game, which is what I like to see.
And he's moving his feet, too, and that's a key thing for him to get involved in the play and have some success. Next question from Trevor Whitehead on Twitter. Who needs to move off the power play right now? And this is an interesting question coming after the power play has scored in back-to-back games. But I guess we'll see what happens with Brock Besser, what his timeline is. But if he's going to miss any sort of time here, then it's going to be Besser that moves off the power play. And we saw in the limited sample size in the game against LA that they put Hugh Suter there on that top unit. Are there other changes you would make to the power play right now? Or is the fact that they've scored in back-to-back games giving you some pause to say, okay, let's let them go to work here and see what they could create and see if they can gain some momentum?
Yeah, two things here. I think the injury situation of Brock Besser is going to dictate a lot of that, right? So if he is good to go in the next little bit here, then you can start tinkering. But if he's not, yeah, you're going to have to keep that power play the way it is. Sure, they're building confidence. They've scored a couple of goals here, which is good. But, Batch, the single biggest problem I have with this power play are their entries. And, you know, they haven't been clean. It feels like it's very individualistic most of the time, where one player kind of brings it in. And then it kind of has to do their own retrieval. And there's three or four guys that are kind of standing around. It's not very you know, dynamic on the entry. There's not many battles and retrievals going on that opening play as they try to enter the zone. So that's the area. But the solution, I don't think anybody in Power Play 2 is the solution to that. I think these guys, Quinn Hughes, JT Miller, Pedersen, Connor Garland as of right now, and Brock Besser, if he's healthy and good to go, those are your five best players right now, and they're going to have to do to create that. One challenge I do see for Power Play 2, though, is without Connor Garland on it, they're really lacking a puck carrier. Sprong's got that in his game, but we haven't necessarily seen it too much. Filip Hronek's got that in his game, but the way to attack the middle of the ice, the way to set up zone time, a Power Play 2 is very much lacking that right now. The priority is Power Play 1, so I don't see that changing. But, yeah, this is, I think, entries for both squads right now, both units, is a big problem.
Yeah, and the only thing I would even think about changing at this point is saying, look, Jake DeBrusk has goals in three straight games. He's on a heater right now. Maybe he's what that top power play unit needs to produce a little bit more. And maybe he will get that chance depending on Besser's timeline. But, you know, there's an old saying that you dance with the person that brought you. You know, the Canucks power play is not going to be fixed by options outside of their best players, and all of their best players are on that first power play unit right now. Last question here, as we're getting tight on time, from @JoeHall_21. And this is a one we're going to have to think through here, Randy. The top five, or he doesn't say top five, he says five overrated players in the NHL right now. So I'll go first. When I think of overrated players, and this, again, overrated is a very specific term, and I know the guys on Canucks Central talk about this all the time when they do overrated, underrated. Just because you're overrated does not mean you're not good. It means the hype around you is maybe more than is deserving. And my mind immediately goes to one of the guys that's going to be coming into Rogers Arena on Saturday night, and that's Zach Hyman, who had a tremendous year last year, 54 goals, added 16 more in 25 playoff games, has had a slow start to this season with only 3 goals through his first 14 games. But, you know, not that he's a bad player, not that he's not a big offensively capable guy. He had been a 20-goal scorer in his career a couple of times before he joined the Oilers. But I think he's a perfect example of being a beneficiary of playing with two of the best players in the league and having an opportunity to generate on that ridiculous power play with Leon Draisaitl and Connor McDavid.
Yeah, we talked about it earlier with Quinn Hughes. The special players make the other players around them look good. Zach Hyman, I think his time in Toronto was probably underrated to a certain extent, the way that he was, you know, able to play really that Alex Burrows role, right, for the Toronto Maple Leafs, being a player that was all effort all the time. But, you know, having covered a lot of his games in Toronto, he's not a 50-goal scorer on a normal team. That's a Connor McDavid aspect. Certainly helps, and the Leon Draisaitl element. I got another one, and this is a player that might not surprise a lot of people, but for me it's Trevor Zegras. Zegras is, you know, fall from grace has kind of been documented here, a little bit to do with the injury last year. He only played 31 games, but even prior to that, you know, 60-point player. His salary is not huge, but for the amount of attention he gets in the NHL world just based on his personality, I'm sorry, the player just doesn't match it for my level. He's playing on the third line of a bad team right now, and we've started to see that shine wear off a little bit, but, you know, for the amount of attention that Zegras got, I think he was probably seen as a player coming out of college as being a really, really difference-making player. He hasn't really panned out. He doesn't have a complete game, and there's a reason he was rumored to be traded in the offseason. There's, I think, rumblings about him in Montreal. A good player, but not exactly a player that I think deserves to be in a lot of the conversations he's been in the last couple of years.
Yeah, so I'm trying to think if there are more because he asked for five overrated players and we've come up with a couple. There are
I'll give you
guys,
another one.
okay, there are guys traditionally I would think of as overrated that I think their rating has changed. So at one time I might have said Taylor Hall, but I think people sort of understand what he is at this point of his career. You could look at Matt Duchene, but I think he's almost having a career resurgence to a certain extent. So who else do you have?
Well, I think another player that's kind of been going through it the last 2 years is Pierre-Luc Dubois, right? Because he's still got a reputation of being a two-way guy, being the individual that on his day can be a difference maker. But when is his day, right? We don't see it often enough. So I know in Washington, he's turning it around. He's playing on a good line right now. But that's still, it's kind of like one of those players. Until you prove you're worth the multiple teams you've been on and that salary, I still think he's in that overrated discussion. He hasn't hit the level that a lot of people expected him. And to be quite honest, like if you throw your weight around in player leverage, you better back it up. And he hasn't been able to do that.
Are there any goaltenders that come to mind? Like, I wonder about Alexander Georgiev, who, again, I think his reputation is taking a hit because of some of the struggles that he's had recently. But, he was a guy that was very highly thought of that maybe isn't there anymore.
I don't know about goalies. I have to think about that, but I think the obvious one that we've missed is takes up 14% of the cap hit in Pittsburgh. It's Erik Karlsson, right? If you've looked at, and I was watching the game, the night that Vancouver played LA, Pittsburgh was playing Carolina, and Erik Karlsson has never been a great defensive defenseman, but he is getting absolutely pulled apart in transition. His defensive play is not good. He's got two primary assists this year. This is one of the best playmaking defensemen of an era, and he is not doing what he's expected to do in Pittsburgh. I think Erik Karlsson is very much in that discussion, if not at the top of that list.
And another defenseman you could put in there, Seth Jones, maybe, as a guy that, is now a part of a Blackhawks team that isn't very good. And we talk about how truly great players elevate the players around them. From watching the Blackhawks a little bit, I'm not sure if I see that from Seth Jones as a guy that, essentially has to be a leader and an important part of a team that's rebuilding. And I don't know if there's a lot there anymore with Seth Jones in his game right now.
All right, so Seth Jones is one, and I think, on a better team, he might feature better. But here's a name that maybe we haven't thought about in a long time because the team hasn't been good. Thomas Chabot came into the league being, first round pick. He was highly touted. He got a long-term 8-year contract. If I'm not mistaken, he's making $8 million per year. Just hasn't really panned out to that level. Sure, Ottawa hasn't been a good team, but I think that ceiling that everybody had for Chabot in the first 2 or 3 years of the league, of him being in the league, hasn't really come close to achieving that. So I would throw Thomas Chabot in that conversation as well.
And I'll cap this off by picking another Oiler, which is timely because the Canucks are playing them
Of
on
course.
Saturday. Darnell Nurse.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Right? As a guy that's making an absolute ton of money right now and is kind of an anchor on that Oilers back end. And we saw some of the defensive struggles in the playoffs. There's still many years left on that deal of him making north of $9 million, and that is not looking like it's going to age well at this point in his career. And you know what? Guys go through ebbs and flows and ups and downs. So maybe he'll get back to being the kind of defenseman that he was prior to signing that contract. But right now, Darnell Nurse, as compared to his paycheck, is certainly overrated.
It's funny how we were having this conversation off air and we're like, oh man, it's going to be tough to come up with overrated players. It's just a hard conversation. We cranked him up pretty good here, Batch. Once you get going, it's easy to start having some opinions here.
Yeah, and I'm sure we could go on, but we are out of time on the show this week. So before we get out of here, Randeep, you're going to be on Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi, on Saturday night. So you won't be calling the Canuck Oiler game with me on Sportsnet 650. What do you guys have coming up on your show?
Well, we've got the classic rivalry, Montreal versus Toronto, game one of the doubleheader, and game two will be Vancouver Edmonton. So a rivalry weekend on Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi.
Yeah, and on Sportsnet 650, I will be on the call alongside Brett Festerling. The pregame show will get underway at 6, the drop of the puck between the Canucks and Oilers from Rogers Arena just after 7. Thanks for listening to In the Booth this week. Again, if you missed any part of the show, it lives as a podcast on the Canucks Central feed, and we'll talk to you again soon right here on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.